Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and you know we're heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca. Well, with the usual wars and rumors of war losing media cachet, the situation on the Korean Peninsula is being trumpeted as a more immediate threat to set Armageddon-weary hearts racing in terror anew. But before tearing off to the family bomb shelter, perhaps a closer look at the media and the way it presents the global reality to we who merely sit and wait is necessary. Before the Korean crisis, there was Iran, prepared to, starting with Israel, immolate the world with its reputed nuclear weapons program. Tehran's program, the story goes, poses such a grave danger to the international community, many in the press prescribe a preemptive nuclear operation, a surgical strike that, while killing millions, would spare hundreds of millions a cancerous atomic metastasizing. Danny Schechter, the news dissector, is a longtime media interpreter, filmmaker, radio and internet pioneer, and author, whose book titles include Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, Its Companion, The Crime of Our Time, Why Wall Street is Not Too Big to Jail, Embedded, Weapons of Mass Deception, Media Wars, News at a Time of Terror, and The More You Watch, The Less You Know, his latest film release, Plunder, the movie. Danny is freshly returned from a trip to one of the axes of evil, Iran. Lucky to have escaped with his life. Danny Schechter in the first half. And last week, the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association discovered a provincial audit of RCMP policing services. As the deadline for the RCMP's 20-year contract is coming up for renewal, the BCCLA thought it a good idea to review that review. A good idea, perhaps, but not thought so by everyone, it seems. David Eby, Executive Director of BC's Civil Liberties Association, in the second half on the mysterious case of the elusive RCMP audit. And Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV broadcaster Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to bring us news from Victoria Streets and beyond. But first, Danny Schechter dissecting the news from Tehran and back again. Stick around.
Thank you.
Well, welcome to the program. Welcome back to the program,
thank you.
Danny.
I don't know if I can talk as fast as you do.
Okay, well.
I could try, but I don't think I have to. You know, it's interesting when you said he got out with his life. Well, I almost didn't get out because I was only given a 7-day visa, even though I was there for 11 days. So, you know, I spent a lot of time in various police stations trying to get my visa extended. It finally was 15 minutes before my flight out. So I did make it out, indeed, and I did have a really great time there. I was there as a judge on a film festival, a short film festival, an international festival, with lots of submissions from all over the world, including Canada. And we had a group of judges, including the vice president of Cuban TV, an Egyptian filmmaker, the head of the Al Jazeera Film Festival, and on. So it was a very diverse group, and I was really intrigued not only by meeting people from Iran, but also meeting this international group of artists and filmmakers and people from around the world who, you know, were very drawn by Iran's culture and its commitment to culture, which is something we don't hear very much. What we hear about, you know, is centrifuges and nuclear speculation, but very little hard information. And nevertheless, it doesn't seem to matter because Israel has said Iran represents an existential threat. Unfortunately, Jean-Paul Sartre is not around to interpret that as the man who gave us existentialism. So, you know, it's all in the eye of the beholder. And what's interesting in all the WikiLeaks that have come out about Iran, all the different calls for military action by Arab nations and Israel, nobody, including the United States, ever looked at the potential of actually down with Iran and trying to work out whatever we can work out with them. The assumption is we won't be able to work anything out, so why bother trying? So that's the problem here. Peaceful initiatives, efforts to try to resolve problems, come last on the list of things to do.
Well, Danny, I've heard that the Persian film industry is in a renaissance right now, and it's a flowering. I remember a famous Nazi saying, though, when he hears the words culture, he reaches for his pistol. What about the what about this the film festival you were at? Was there political films there? Were there any films that dared
to
criticize?
I was surprised that there weren't more, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, there were four categories we judged. One was fictional shorts, nonfiction documentaries, experimental films, and animation. And, you know, so some of that was sort of vaguely political, but not really explicitly political. It was nothing like, you know, the old Soviet films or anything like that. Now, Iran has made films about its war with Iraq and other conflicts and its revolution, but people in the West don't seem to want to watch them, so it's been hard for them to distribute them internationally. But they're known for really excellent features and the like, and, you know, the sensibility there. I did go see one new film, which was about, you know, believe it or not, you know, King David's son, and, you know, kind of a theological kind of a film. Another film was made about Jesus, you know, interpreting him from a Quranic point of view. I mean, it is an Islamic culture there, and, you know, a lot of things are rooted with references to the Quran and references to Islam, but there's also a very sort of hip, young generation there, you know, who have house parties, who are basically living in the Islamic Republic without really supporting it, and are critical of the government, critical and outspoken about it. So, you know, it wasn't something where people were afraid to talk to me and tell me what they thought. They were very upfront about it, you know. And so, you know, it's a set of contradictions like anywhere else. But it's also, you know, kind of far more complex than you would, you know, have the impression of, you know, some mullah or ayatollah telling everybody what to do. I don't think it works that way.
Well, of course, the media here presents Iran as a monolith and the people within it as being either oppressed by this wicked state.
Well, I was
state.
Very struck, you know. You know, of course, Bush, you know, put Iran in the axis of evil. And on my last day there, I visited the former U.S. embassy, which was the scene of the hostage taking in 1979. It was the center of the Iranian Revolution in many respects. It got the most attention in the West, certainly the seizing of American hostages. And the embassy is still there. It's become sort of a museum because when they seized it, they also seized a lot of spy equipment and, you know, espionage, you know, stuff that was there, cryptographic machines and shredders and, you know, all of this sort of stuff. And the Americans shredded all their documents. This is in the pre-WikiLeaks period. And the Iranian students patiently actually sewed the shredded material back together again and recreated the documents that had gone through the shredder. Now, they didn't save everything because some of the stuff was burned, some of it was put in chemical vats, but, you know, so a lot of the documents that went through the shredder were put back together again and became best-selling books, a whole collection of books of these documents, which, of course, were used to make a case that, you know, American imperialism, American government was, you know, interfering in Iranian affairs, which it certainly had been back in 1953. There was the overthrow of the Mossadegh government, which was a sort of nationalist government that wanted to nationalize the oil industry, and that was too much for the British and the Americans to take. And so there was a actual, you know, coup there led by the United States, which led to the elevation of the Shah, who became rather oppressive in his last days and, you know, triggered the Iranian Revolution. So, you know, it's one thing to talk tough and everything else. It's another thing to try to actually do something about it that's effective. We see that in the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, the U.S. has the military advantage, it has the technology, it has the drones, it has the spy centers, it has all of this stuff, but it's losing, okay? And just as, you know, United States Armed Forces lost in Vietnam to, you know, a peasant army. So, you know, just having power and equipment and all of that doesn't necessarily mean that you can prevail. And again, here with Iran, what we saw was that these hostages were held for 444 days. The Carter administration then tried everything, the negotiations, sending in a military rescue effort, which crashed, burned. You know, so it's been, you know, in a sense, relations have been frozen ever since then, over 30 years now. There doesn't seem to be any effort here to try to break through in any way. Obama sent a New Year's message, you know, a year and a half ago to Iran, you know, promising some sort of new policy and discussions, but there was never any follow-up on it.
Well, yeah, many people forget that Israel wasn't always the only democracy in the Middle East, that Iran actually predated that democracy. or was the first Arab
democracy.
It's
clear that Israel isn't a democracy because it seems like a really a government run by a military, you know, war committee, essentially.
Well,
you know, which basically has the real power in the same way that in Iran, the government, you know, that we have learned to love to hate, it does not have the real power. It's the supreme ruler, Khatami, who's really in charge, following in the, you know, footsteps of Ayatollah Khomeini. So it's a theocratic government, and the military in Iran reports to the supreme leader, not to the government.
Well, now, Danny, for at least the last four and a half years, there's been a real concerted push by media, mostly led by Israel's backers in the United States, to attack Iran. There's been no secret about that within Israel as well. Let me finish for a second, Danny, because I want to make one point that just yesterday there were four scientists, Iranian scientists within Iran, that were murdered in two separate car bombings. The Iranian authorities, of course, are pointing the finger at Israel, but there's been a long line of terrorist attacks within Iran over the last number of years. What about this now? How about the ongoing actual military attacks against the country?
Well, there were reports in the paper when I was there of, quote, terrorists being captured in the western part of Iran. No doubt there's covert action being taken there to try to stimulate, you know, conflict, to try to challenge the police, to try to really get ethnic groups against one another and all the rest of it. It's the old, from the sort of play, the divide and rule playbook is still in play in many places. And, you know, so yeah, I mean, Iran is at war right now. We're at war with Iran. We're using sanctions. We're using psychological psyops. We're using, you know, threats. Various kinds, international agencies trying to isolate them, and of course they're trying to get around that isolation. We have American politicians like Lindsey Graham of South Carolina calling for the sinking of the Iranian Navy and bombing Iran. You know, McCain, you know, and Dick Cheney had both, you know, kind of joked about this. So, you know, Iran is very conscious of the fact that it's sort of under attack, and the fact that nuclear scientists apparently were assassinated, I don't know all the details, you know, is not surprising given this state of undeclared war.
Well, what about this now? Yeah, you were going to mention Israel. Now, Israel has been saying that Iran poses an existential threat to Israel, that Ahmadinejad has said on many occasions, according to them, that he wants to wipe Israel off the map. This, again, the media picks up and runs with. What about this?
Well, the Iranians, I asked about this. You know, I was sort of, you know, I'm Jewish, I'm there in the Islamic Republic. You know, I was concerned about this. I raised it. They said, absolutely not. They're against Zionism. They're against this Zionist philosophy, the oppression of Palestinians. They're not against Jews per se. In fact, there were, you know, something like 30,000 Jews in Iran. There had been a much bigger Jewish community there. And, you know, there's a member of their parliament who's Jewish. They're not, they say, anti-Semitic. They are anti-Zionist. They make that distinction. Of course, when Israelis hear that, they go ballistic. They say it's no such thing. You know, you're anti-Semitic by definition if you're anti-Zionist. If you're a Jew and you criticize Zionism, you are, by definition, a self-hating Jew. And that's what they say. They try to tarnish all the critics, you know, stereotype them and make a caricature out of them. And this is one of the difficulties that you have. So you have more, paradoxically, you have more debate about Israeli policy in Israel than you do in other countries, okay? Or that it's sort of permissible in other countries, because when people criticize Israel, you know, they tend to be labeled as anti-Semites.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CAFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on the cable, and CAFUV.uvic.ca on the internet everywhere else. I'm speaking tonight with Danny Schechter, and Danny Schechter, the news dissector, is a longtime media interpreter, a filmmaker, radio and internet pioneer, and author whose books include Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, Its Companion, The Crime of Our Time, Is Not Too Big to Jail, and his latest film is Plunder, the Movie. Well, Danny, you have been like a man with his hair on fire for the last couple years, you know, saying that, you know, this economic system was heading for a cliff, and you were sadly proven right. Well, now where are we in this, Danny? And where's is the next shoe ready to drop, or
you know,
what?
I'm glad you asked, because most people don't want to know. In fact, in the last week, of course, there's been all this hype about Christmas shopping. You know, all these reports of a tremendous surge. They use the word surge like they do in, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq, you know, in online sales and all the rest of it, implying that the economy is coming back. A study came out today basically saying that the amount of increase on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving in America, which is the start of the Christmas shopping season, you know, the reports were completely ecstatic about it. Oh, the malls are packed, blah, blah, blah. Turns out, you know, mostly people rush there because they deeply discount a few high-profile items to get people into the stores, but those are the only items people buy, and sales only went up 0.03%, according to this study I saw today, which is, when you factor in inflation, it's actually a net drop. So there's not really, you know, shopping is not going to save our economy, even though our economy is structured around consumption, not production. And, you know, the need for creating jobs is being foiled by the Republicans, who don't even want to give people unemployment benefits, much less put any kind of stimulus into the economy. So, you know, in a sense, they want to blame the Democrats for the collapse that they're helping to engineer. And that's what's going on right now. There's no, you know, unemployment, it seems the needle hasn't really moved. Foreclosures up to 14 million families, 50 million Americans on food stamps. I mean, this is a disaster area here. And it's not a disaster like the floods in Pakistan or the earthquake in Haiti. That's a physical disaster, but this is a sort of an economic catastrophe that's underway. And, you know, people don't really report it. Most of the, quote, business news is about the market. Is it up? Is it down? You know, this deal and that deal. Very little about the pain that ordinary Americans are experiencing. And this is what I've been writing about in my blog on mediachannel.org, newsdissector.com/blog, and also articles and commentaries, which you've been good enough to publish.
Well, Danny, you mentioned the I word, inflation, but your president, Mr. Obama, is going the other way, mentioning the D word, deflation. Now, clearly, there's a disconnect there. Now, from people, little people like me and most of, I guess, 90% of the population, we've seen the price of everything go up, and yet Mr. Obama says he's worried about deflation. What should I believe?
Well, you know, here's the situation. I mean, when you start cutting back on services, okay, when you start, you know, suddenly there's a freeze on Social Security, usually there's this cost of living increase. There wasn't one this year. When the price of transportation goes up, when the price of gasoline goes up, when, you know, basic necessities continue to rise, food prices go up in part because of all the speculation about food and commodities. So, you know, you're in a situation where Americans are making less and things are costing more. That's the squeeze, you know, that people are feeling, and they're talking about it, but there's no political representation really for that point of view, and the media, by and large, is not focusing on it. They're trying to get more and more ads for consumer goods, you know, to save themselves, because they're in bad shape themselves.
Well, we're seeing Ireland going through a hell of a time right now. The IMF and the European Union Central Bank has made some draconian demands as a bailout provision. But Ireland had the government of Ireland had given over billions to the bank, the billions of euros to the banking sector that had done the same thing in Ireland as it did here with these derivatives and phony mortgages and all the rest of it. When you say that why Wall Street is not too big to jail, well, what about that? I mean, are we going to jail these guys? Or in Ireland, it looks like they're going to hang them.
I mean, the effort to try to create some sort of sensible global system of regulation and shared rules and regulations governing the financial sector, that's sort of been foiled. The United States doesn't want to, you know, play ball with other countries. You know, in some cases, there are stronger rules against, you know, financial crime in England than there is in America, more regulation there. You know, we have a situation where it's a sort of slow-motion disaster movie here. You know, we have another several hundred banks that are destined to fail. We have, you know, corporations doing better than ever, but not creating jobs, putting money for acquisitions and for salaries, bonus. And so, you know, what's happening is there's an incredible transfer of wealth going on from the working class and the middle class to the upper class, you know, to the super rich, basically. And that we have the largest stratification, if you will, or, you know, gap between rich and poor in American history. So all of this is underway, but it's covered, you know, occasionally, but not in a regular way. You know, we have the Dow Jones average shows you what the stock market is doing, but we don't have, like, here's the unemployment statistics today. Here's Mrs. Jones, who just got thrown off of her, who just lost all of her benefits. You know, those kinds of stories are reported, but they're reported in a way that most people can't relate to. When I worked for ABC News, and I did the first story on the SNL crisis savings and loan crisis back in the late 80s, you know, my bosses warned me, please don't get too complex, don't get too complicated. People tune out. And they actually have in television something called the MEGO effect, M-E-G-O, which stands for my eyes glaze over, you know. And this is the assumption that the audience just doesn't want or won't listen to or will tune out, you know, any sort of complexity. And as a result, this is a cultural conditioning and training in America not to ask too many questions, not to go too deep, and the rest. And you know, so we'll have a lot of incidents, you know, the miners escaping from their fate in Chile, but very little about what put them into that pickle in the first place, the mine owners and the whole situation there. So, you know, this is the problem, is that our coverage is extremely simplistic. It's really designed in many cases to make you feel better about the world, not really to inform you about it. And as a result, we've had this financial disaster with very little coverage. And one of the things I show in my movie, Plunder, the Crime of Our Time, is the complicity of the media itself, how the media was sort of hyping the housing boom, not challenging it, not questioning it, not investigating it. And, you know, that $3 billion in advertising went into radio, television, and the Internet between 2002 and 2007. And so suddenly all the dodgy lenders and credit card companies, you know, were advertising, you know, in the media itself. And there was, you know, if you're a television executive, you don't want to investigate your advertisers. So, you know, the media sort of went along with it. And, you know, they were as shocked as anybody else when the whole thing collapsed, as it will continue to do.
Well, Danny, we've only got a minute left, but I mean, we saw recently, of course, the Republicans have taken the House, the Congressional House. And maybe this was because of the Citizens United decision, which allowed that corporations in the United States could give unlimited amounts of money in election campaigns without having to account for it. They don't have to say where, you know, the people
that's
running.
That's been a big factor. But, you know, you also have the Obama administration's moved, you know, to the center. Its refusal to really stand up for its core constituency, its key voters, unwilling to challenge Wall Street and all the rest of it. So they've, you know, aided and abetted the Republicans and until the last minute when, you know, what were they really offering? People didn't feel that they were standing up for them either. And, you know, so this is a problem. There's been a political failure here. There's been a media failure here. And, of course, this financial failure and a military failure. So, you know, we have a society, you know, in serious trouble, and it's not clear how it's going to be saved, you know. So, you know, people want any more information about this, you know, I have a website called PlunderTheCrimeOfOurTime.com. You can check out my film and my book and my blog at newsdissector.com/blog. I write about this every day. I mean, I'm trying to do what I can do to inform people about it, but it's an uphill battle.
Well, you're doing a great job, Danny, and of course, as you mentioned, some of your stuff is available at my website, too, pacificfreepress.com. Thanks a lot, Danny, for coming on the show again.
Hey, much obliged. Keep up the good work that you're doing. I think that deserves a little bit of support from your listeners and readers.
Well, you're very kind. Until the next time, then, Danny.
Great. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Now I'm going to take a brief break, but when I come back, I'm going to be joined by Janine, and she's going to bring us up to speed with some of the things going on a little bit closer to home. So do stick around for that.
I grew up in a normal home in a normal town. All of a sudden, everything got crazy. I didn't talk to anybody about the way I was feeling. I was scared, and I was alone. I started drinking. I just didn't want to deal with what was happening in my life. I knew about AA, but I thought I was too young. I found out I was wrong. If you're having a problem with your drinking, why don't you give us a call?
AA. It works. Look us up in the phone book or check your local newspapers.
Hello, welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca on the internet everywhere else. Joining me now, as oft time she does, is Janine. Hey, Janine.
Hey, Chris, what do you make of all this WikiLeaks stuff?
I haven't read any of it, so I don't know. I've just been listening to some of the media takes on it and what they decide to emphasize, and you really get a good idea of where the media is at when you listen to how they deal with the issue. Do they just talk about, oh, these guys are putting soldiers at risk, or they should be arrested, or what? But not really getting to the meat of what was released. It's early days right now. I do have a link, actually, at pacificfreepress.com to the WikiLeaks site. I couldn't get through to it last night, when all the big hoop-de-doo was going on, because they had, at long last, released the long-anticipated files. And not all of the files that they said they were going to release in this go, because they've been kind of doing these gradually, have been released. There's going to be more sort of strategically released over the next period. I can't honestly say I've read any of it, so I really don't know.
Well, it's interesting. I've joined the Twitter now.
Awesome.
And I must say, I kind of like the Twitter. And there's talk of how, Julian Assange is being charged with treason and all of this. And then folks are mentioning Valerie Plame,
right?
By comparison. You recall when Valerie Plame was outed as a CIA operative?
Yeah,
well, those people weren't charged with treason.
Well, just another case of hypocrisy. But yeah, Joe Wilson, they were trying to get at the former ambassador because he was questioning the yellow cake uranium from Niger, which he had been in the ambassadorial service. He had served as ambassador to that country. But his wife, Valerie Plame, was the CIA agent. There's a movie out, actually, with Sean Penn starring, and I can't remember who plays Plame right now, but that's got very good reviews, about the case. But yeah, that was Scooter Libby. He did get sort of chased out of office. He was not elected office, but he was in with the Bush team and that, or he was Cheney's number one, he narrowly missed it. And the journalist that he used, the CIA asset since dead that he used, never got charged with anything. Robert Novak.
Right, and as you mentioned, it's all the focus is all about whether this is going to be putting people in danger, and it's not looking at what's the meat of or the guts of the bad metaphors, eh? Our language is weird sometimes. What's
blood
the
and
heart
guts.
of the documents? And I'm interested in who, like, somebody inside has leaked. He didn't steal them, right?
Well,
so somebody is thinking that this is worth doing.
Well, Bradley Manning is the person who is in jail right now, charged with this. He hasn't gone to court, and knowing the way the American system is these days, maybe he never will. They'll just keep him alongside Omar Khadr. But he was a corporal in the U.S. military who had reported, purportedly, and I heard this, I think it was on Democracy Now! Today, but he had reported some what amounts to war crimes. His colleagues and he were turning over captured Iraqis that were guilty of nothing to Iraqi forces to be imprisoned and tortured and in some cases killed as well. And when he brought this to the attention of his uppers, they told him just to keep his mouth shut. And then he sort of started looking at what he was doing there and decided that it was his duty to expose what was going on. And he happened to be in a position, if this is true, I mean, this is all alleged, but he happened to be in a position where he could intercept signals. And he started amassing vast quantities of signals going back and forth over the computer desk that he was at, and over a period of a couple of years, and he got hundreds of thousands of files, and then turned them over to WikiLeaks.
Well, I would be surprised if he's the only one inside that thinks that things need to be exposed and changed and all that sort of thing. So I'm not sure how to segue from there to Victoria's Streets, but I know I only have a couple of minutes, and I do want to mention a couple of things, Chris.
Yeah, go.
you remember Blind Kenny, the story of Blind Kenny, who lost his partner 42 years and ended up in the hospital and homeless, and it was a horrible, horrible story. Well, it seems that it's going to have a happy ending. Some friends managed to find a place for him to live, and it's a friendly place, and they have social events, and he's hopefully going to be moving in this week sometime. So that's kind of good news.
Yeah.
Amidst the bad news, which, now this is interesting, unless you talk to the right people in the street community, you never know these things happen. I don't read the corporate news, so that could be what happened too, but did you hear about three people being stabbed in Victoria on November 11th?
No, I missed that.
One of them died. His name was Mark.
Oh.
And apparently the guy that did it is quite known in the community. He was recently released from a federal penitentiary, and there's a little bit of upset because he was taken. He wasn't even handcuffed when he was taken. By comparison, the fellow who was taken in for questioning over the Dean Fortin, Mayor Dean's house vandal, the spray paint and the smashed car window, was taken into custody for 24 hours. His apartment was trashed, apparently. This is what I've heard, that the cops went in and, like, threw everything out of his drawers and closets and that sort of thing. They took him in for questioning, I think, about 24 hours. His friends were outside the police station at the front waiting, you know, in showing support, and they released the guy out the back door and didn't tell his friends. So tricks like this, my friend. So this is what the cops do. They play tricks on us. So it's really kind of unfortunate what's going on out there. There's also the story of the pharmacy, you know, the pharmacy on Pandora that was distributing needles.
Yes.
And nobody complained about it. Nobody even knew about it. But the cops found out about it, went to the media, I think is what happened. And then now it's causing a big problem and everybody wants it shut down. So, you know, and so really then it becomes a policing issue rather than a health issue, which is what it really is. So if folks are interested in getting involved in some of these issues, the Committee to End Homelessness is a grassroots organization. They invite everybody's welcome, and they're meeting in December. They've been meeting at Silver Threads, but in December they're going to be meeting at St. Andrews on Douglas Street, Wednesdays at 7.
Yeah, I don't know about the police being used to raid pharmacies. And the pharmacy you mentioned, I understand that they had an agreement that they were providing harm reduction, clean needles and the likes to the drug addicted. These are things that are, I mean, really, folks, do we want people all with hepatitis and all these other diseases that are possible? I mean, you might not agree with their behavior, and you might think, oh, well, you know, they deserve what they get, but be selfish and think, well, the public health means the public, and they don't, you know, these things don't only affect bad people, if that's what you think. I mean,
no, a lot of people
everybody do
this stuff inside their four walls. I mean, that's the only difference, is that some people have walls to do it inside and some people don't.
No,
some people have clean needles and some people are scrounging for them, right?
And should the police be used to intimidate people that aren't breaking any laws? You know?
Right, exactly.
I mean,
and who ordered that? And there's a lot of questions to be asked. Now, there was a meeting planned for November 30th tomorrow at City Hall. Harm Reduction Victoria was going to go and talk to the police board and City Hall, but that has been rescheduled, apparently. Mm-hmm. So if folks want to check in with Harm Reduction Victoria around that.
Well, that's good, because then give you time for more people to get involved. Yeah, Harm Reduction Victoria.
Yeah, nurses and social workers and
those lowlifes. Okay. Okay. Well, Janine, your December street news is out on the streets. You're going to be back in studio next. Is it this Thursday or the following?
Next week. Yeah.
For Winds of Change. So, is there anything else?
Well, there's lots more, but I'm interested in hearing your next guest.
Yeah, that'll be David Eby from the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association. I'll get to him just in a minute, but in the meantime, I'm going to play a little transition music here. This is from the Stanfields, and how do you know they're a Canadian band? Well, look at your underwear. Until the next time, then, Janine.
All right, thanks, Chris. show, pimp ass hoe, decked out in the bling. There ain't nothing wrong with a little hip hop of propositioning. Yes, rip the heart out of the art, turn it to a trend. Bop through money changes, rub the hands and reap the dividends. Here we go!
Well, last week, the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association discovered a provincial audit of the RCMP policing services that it provides to British Columbia. As the deadline for the RCMP's 20-year contract is coming up for renewal, the BCCLA thought it a good idea to review that review, and it may have been a good idea, but not everybody thought so, apparently. Now, David Eby is the executive director of the association. Welcome back to the show, David.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, now, David, I expect few of our listeners are aware of the tendering process involved in the province's contracting out of police services. And given our current government's enthusiasm for free marketeering and P3s, those listeners might be wondering how they can put in their tender. Now, how does that system work?
Well, hopefully we're not moving to a system of fully private policing, but theoretically it could be it. We have a system here in BC where the province is responsible for policing. They can fulfill their constitutional responsibility as they see fit. In Ontario, they do it by establishing a provincial police force. Here in BC, we do it by actually the RCMP provides policing services. They get paid by the province to do policing here. And the province signs a contract every 20 years with them now that basically makes them responsible for doing policing in British Columbia.
Well, now, David, if one's to listen to the media, and not just the BCCLA, it would seem that there are some worrying questions about the level of service and the quality of service that the RCMP and other police agencies, for that matter, are providing to the citizens of this province. One of the most troubling I heard recently is that British Columbia has doubled the national average of police deaths. What about this?
Well, certainly it's our concern. We have a number of concerns about the RCMP in the province. They start with the accountability mechanisms. The RCMP have their own separate complaints process, separate from the municipal provincial processes that have been set up. They have their own training standards, which are separate than the provincial training standards. They have basically no accountability to the province except for through the contract. They're accountable to the federal attorney general. Whereas local police departments like Vancouver, Victoria, for example, Nelson, are accountable to police boards, which are appointed by the province and also by the local municipality. So the RCMP functionally has no accountability in the province of British Columbia. It's all accountable to Ottawa, and even then barely accountable.
Yeah, well, one only needs to think about the Ian Bush case up in Houston, B.C., or Orion Hutchinson killed by an off-duty RCMP officer, an officer that was also involved in the Jaskansky killing at Vancouver National or International Airport as well. And although there was some oversight of those cases, no punishment that I'm aware of was meted out. Am I right there?
Well, the concern that is correct about Jaskansky, the concern that we have is certainly partly that the RCMP seems totally incapable of removing problem officers from their forces. We have one officer in particular that we're watching now with just disbelief as he traveled across the country, killed a man in Newfoundland. He then ended up in Prince George where he assaulted a man and was pled guilty to assault. He broke bones in the man's face, and then he was involved in the death of Clayton Alvin Wiley, who was hogtied and tasered repeatedly. He was also involved in another incident where a provincial court judge said that he and his supervisor participated in destroying the videotape of an incident where a man was tasered repeatedly. Like, this is one police officer who the RCMP still has working for them. The guy who killed Kevin St. Arnaud, Kamloops, and was promptly charged with assault after being involved in a bar fight in off hours. You know, so these are the people who are still working for the RCMP, and don't get me started on this stuff because I can go all night.
Well, I might get you started. I mean, it's not just British Columbia, too, though, because I've got in my hand a piece from today's newspaper out of Edmonton. Alberta man who was badly beaten by an RCMP officer says he did nothing to provoke the attack. Andrew Clyburn told CTV News Saturday that he merely corrected Constable Desmond Sanbo on his last name pronunciation. And what he says, quote, the Mountie lost it. He was beaten up by this cop, and this Alberta Mountie has pled guilty to this assault, although there's nothing in this article at least that says that he's going to be kicked off the force for what he did. Or I mean, what's the usual pattern when these guys, if they admit to what they've done and it's a criminal act, what, no criminal charges? Are they what happens
in our experience? It doesn't matter what the criminal charges are for, whether it's drinking and driving, assault, on duty, off duty, theft. It does not matter. It is as far as we can tell, it's basically impossible to get fired from the RCMP. We've spoken with the commissioner who's in charge now of Western Canada for the RCMP, and he says there are police officers he'd love to get rid of, and he can't because of the way the RCMP Act grievance process is structured. The head of the RCMP himself has said that Commissioner Elliott has said that the RCMP Act is broken in this way, that they can't get rid of problem police officers. I buy that to a certain extent, but the RCMP is also complicit in the fact that they have these problem officers working for them, because when they investigate their own officers, they do such a bad job that functionally they say, well, the officer didn't do anything wrong. And so you can't fire someone for doing nothing wrong when you're shooting Ian Bush in the back of the head. And then you say, well, it was a reasonable use of force. You can't fire someone for using force reasonably. And so they have all these problem officers who remain on the force, and there's no accountability.
Well, maybe these officers aren't doing so badly, but this is a culture that they're in, and they're not seen as doing anything bad because this is the culture. Is that what it is?
You know what? It's interesting. I talked to RCMP officers, and they have such different views. Some of them are absolutely appalled, and mostly it's the senior officers who are close to retirement or have retired. Who are absolutely appalled by what they're seeing in terms of what's happening with our national force, lack of accountability, and the exposure that they're getting for these horrific use of force incidents. And others, I don't know how, with a straight face, they can write the reports, do the investigations that they do. When you have, in the case of Kevin St. Arnaud, you have the partner of the shooting officer, you have a civilian witness, all saying that this police officer shot an unarmed man who was surrendering. Still clear him of the incident. I don't know how you participate in a process like that and still have faith in the force that you're working for expect any confidence from the Canadian public.
Well, I mean, I'm starting to believe that there has to be a environment of impunity. This is what they're protecting because they feel that they can't do some of the things the RCMP, that is, that they are used to doing without granting on their officers this impunity that they seem to enjoy.
Yeah, it's a really vicious circle because what you have is a situation where the officers who are inclined to help. They join the RCMP to help people, to catch bad guys, to make people safe, to save lives. And they sit and they watch while people use excessive force, or they're involved in somebody's death that could have been prevented, that was totally unnecessary. And they see this person functionally get away with it. And we hear that language all the time from the public, from our superior, getting away with it. It's incredibly disheartening. And in fact, there are a large number of people who leave the RCMP no longer wish to participate. And people are then not inclined to join the RCMP. Like, who is signing up to be a young recruit for the RCMP right now? Why would you join a force that's under such scrutiny and seems to be so unaccountable? And so it's a self-reinforcing cycle that the good people are leaving or not joining. And then all you have left are these people that you can't fire. It's an incredibly problematic scenario that the RCMP is facing right now, and they really have to turn it around.
Well, is there anybody outside of the RCMP addressing this, the Parliament or the Senate? I mean, is there anybody that is in a position of authority in this country seriously looking at this and looking at remedies for it?
I mean, the problem for politicians is that it's such a... it's such a real mess to step into. If you start poking sticks at the RCMP, into the eyes of the RCMP, the RCMP have incredible powers to announce that they're doing investigations of various political figures and to turn whole elections. We saw that around the income trust matters and the federal liberals. I mean, this is not a force with a significant amount of political power and influence. And so you want to really make sure that if you're going after the RCMP, that you're doing it in a way that's not going to imperil your own political life. And even though the RCMP has had so many public scandals, there still is a large amount of public trust and confidence in local police forces because people don't have interactions with the RCMP. They don't deal with them. And these incidents are seen as a few bad apples rather than a systemic issue within the RCMP. And so if you go after them as a politician, people are saying, well, these are the people who responded when I was in a car accident, or they broke up a meth lab next to my house. You know, why are you blaming the RCMP? It's not their fault. And so there's a real reluctance to go after the RCMP in terms of politicians. With that said, Nathan Cullen up north in BC has launched a private members bill, which failed, of course, to establish civilian investigation of RCMP misconduct.
Well, I think that would just be normal. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and cfuv.uvic.ca everywhere else on the internet. I'm speaking tonight with David Eby, and David is the executive director of the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association. Well, now, David, the RCMP have a quite a unique role within Canada in police. They police our small neighborhoods and our highways and such, but they're also involved in the intelligence networks internationally and nationally. Is that perhaps another reason that people might be a little reluctant to take them on here?
Well, this is actually one of the critiques that's been leveled against the RCMP is, can you imagine the FBI in the United States providing contract police services in the states to individual states, that the FBI police would rent themselves out functionally to a state to provide policing? They've got far too much to do in terms of national crime, national security initiatives, these kinds of things, to be bothering with the logistics of day-to-day policing, traffic control, these kinds of things in smaller communities. And so John Major, former Justice John Major, who did the Air India inquiry, said that the RCMP really needs to focus its mandate on national crime and national security issues. It shouldn't be dabbling in the sort of contract policing of the provinces. It's a massive distraction for them. It's not where they should be putting their attention. And we're inclined to agree with that. It doesn't make sense to have a body that's answerable to Ottawa doing local policing. In Vancouver, like it or not, there is a police board here. You can bring policy complaints to. They're responsive to local community issues. And the province said that they were going to arrest homeless people that refused to report to shelters. The police board approved a policy where the VPD said they weren't going to use that policy. So, you know, it can be responsive to the concerns of local community. For the RCMP, there's no equivalent. I mean, certainly, I think it's fair to say that there are lots of issues with RCMP intelligence gathering, with where they see threats around activism, where they see threats around dissent as being equivalent to a threat to security, and probably dissent against RCMP practices as being a threat to national security. But with that said, they really shouldn't be involved in the contract policing.
Well, what does the provincial government say? Now, we've started out with this release by the BCCLA about this provincial audit in advance of the 20-year tenure. Why these tenures have to be in 20-year increments is something we might talk about as well. But so what does the auditors think about the RCMP, David?
Well, this is the million-dollar question. Actually, it's the multi-billion-dollar question in British Columbia. This is a massive untendered contract for which there is zero accountability to local taxpayers, and certainly it's not our aspiration to be the taxpayers' defense fund by any stretch, but certainly it's our very firm belief that citizens need to know what government is doing on their behalf, how they're allocating the resources and the power that citizens give them, and citizens need all the information to do that. We think it's a great idea that the province went out and did an audit of the RCMP. Anytime you have a sole source contractor that's providing, that has a huge amount of secrecy over the services that they're providing under the guise of national or local security, needs to be audited to make sure that there's not issues of corruption, to make sure there's not issues of theft, to make sure that there's not issues of simple lack of accountability to what the local community needs. And so this audit is well-timed and it's appropriate. But the issue we have is that the province would go out and they do an audit of the RCMP and then not tell the citizens what the audit says and say, well, we're going to go ahead and sign another 20-year deal with the RCMP, but trust us, we're going to release the audit. Well, they said this recently, but they didn't even say anything about the audit. They just said, we're going to go ahead and sign another deal with the RCMP. But when we revealed that there was an audit, then they said, well, just trust us. Just before we're ready to ink the deal, then we'll release the audit to the public at that stage. We have the provincial government still asking the BCCLA for $700 just to do the search for the documents around the audit, even though everybody knows where the audit is, everybody knows how it is, they just are refusing to give it up.
Well, can they do that? I mean, we've got freedom of information legislation in this province, don't we? I mean, why is this so difficult? How are they justifying their reluctance to part with this information?
Well, unfortunately, we have the worst record, according to an audit done by the Freedom of Information Protection Privacy Group, advocacy group here that we have in British Columbia, in terms of our province's responses to freedom of information requests. We're already more than 2 months into the process of requesting this audit, we have to file an appeal of now the refusal to grant us a fee waiver, as well as the refusal to grant us all of the documents around the audit, the emails, the reports, these kinds of things. Basically, they've tied us up in administrative knots and appeals for at least foreseeable, I'd say, 6 to 8 months.
And
by that time, the RCMP contract is signed, everything is done. And so that's why we went public and we said, look, province, you need to release this report now. You know where it is. You know what it says. At least tell us what the highlights are.
Well, what about the signing of that contract now? Can the RCMP not continue their services without a signed contract for an interim period that's reasonable for the people of British Columbia to access and to interpret the results of this audit and maybe discuss alternatives?
Oh, absolutely. It'd be very easy for the province and the RCMP to extend the current terms of the contract for another year without rushing into this contract. But I guess the frustrating part about this is that it's not like this contract date snuck up on us. This was a 20-year contract that was signed in 1990. Everybody knew that this date was coming. Everybody knew that the RCMP were considered the primary bidders. The province was really reluctant to look at anybody else other than the RCMP. They did some kind of an evaluation about how much it would cost to do provincial policing. They haven't released that information. They apparently did an audit of the RCMP. We don't know when, Rich Coleman says that it's not done yet. I mean, it's November 2010. This contract expires in 2012, January 2012. So the audit isn't even done yet. And you know, it's just hard to imagine that could be the scenario. So for an incredible lack of government planning or lack of foresight, or in the alternative, a decision that was made a long time ago that it would be known by the RCMP and that really nobody cared about what the terms of the contract would be.
Well, if it's the start date is 2012, then are they going to wait until late 2011 to sign this renewal, or are they going to have this renewal signed earlier?
Well, in our conversations with Police Services Division, there were media reports saying that they hope to have it signed by the end of the year. Our conversations with Police Services Division say that there are still some pretty major issues that have to be worked out. They've made some progress in some areas, but they don't expect to have it signed by January 2010. And, you know, at this stage, I don't even know what to say. I mean, how you can have a major contract like this worth tens of billions of dollars take place in a completely anti-transparent way I guess it reflects why the government's approval ratings are so low. But, you know, the lack of willingness to engage the public on what kind of policing services do you want? Are the RCMP satisfying your requirements? Are there other ways we can deliver policing services? Are there things the police are doing that would be better paid for through provincial health care money, like sobering centers and taking drunken public arrests out of police custody? You know, none of those discussions have taken place, and it's just so frustrating.
Well, we've only got a couple minutes left here, David, but I don't want to let you go without talking about, I know the BCCLA is a very busy organization, and you're doing great work in covering a myriad issues. And another one of those issues has to do with the Military Police Commission. Now, you've got a piece up here about the Military Police Commission to hear key witnesses in torture hearings. This harkens back to the Stephen Harper interruptus of Canada's involvement in handing over Afghani detainees to be tortured and killed, something that the WikiLeaks is fundamental in those files being released to WikiLeaks on the American side of it. What's the story here with the Military Police Commission, David?
Well, the story, actually, I don't know if you saw it, Christopher Will Turn today. This is an issue of Canadian soldiers operating in Afghanistan. The military police are the ones who take custody of the prisoners of war and turn them over to the Afghan authority. And the concern has been that the Afghan authority has not been willing to offer guarantees that the detainees won't be tortured or otherwise mistreated by the authority. And Canada hasn't bothered to seek those guarantees. So the question is, how much did Canada know? Detainees are coming out and saying, hey, I was tortured, I was hit by a metal braided cable, and then the Canadian investigators find the cable exactly where the detainees say it was. So this is the key issue. But today, we find out after, and we've been in this hearing, in hearings with the Department of Justice, federal government for years now, around this issue, we find out for years the Canadian government has actually been taking children prisoner in Afghanistan and turning children over to the Afghan authority, the same authority that we knew was involved in torturing prisoners, and alleging that these children are cooperating with the Taliban and making life dangerous for Afghan authority soldiers and Canadian soldiers. So a really major revelation that just came out today, and for some reason, Chris, was not contained in the thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of documentary evidence we've been given so far by the federal government. So we're asking a few questions about how it could possibly be that they have failed to mention to us that they've been arresting children and turning children over to the Afghan authority, not just adults.
And children how young, David?
Well, we don't know. We have no idea. This is a single line from a briefing note inside government that was obtained through somehow by the CBC, which is amazing to us because we have judicial orders enforceable by contempt of court requiring all relevant documents to be disclosed to us. So either the Canadian forces are not recording in their documentation the fact that they're arresting children, or they've actively avoided disclosing this information to us. In either case, it's incredibly problematic.
Well, yeah, contempt indeed. Well, David Eby, that's all the time we have for today. If you want to find out more about what David's work in the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, go to their website at bccla.org, bccla.org. Thanks a lot for the work you're doing, David, and thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks, Chris. Always a pleasure.
All right, then. Until the next time. And thanks to Danny Schechter, Media Dissector. You can check him out at mediachannel.org and Danny Schechter blog. I can't remember what he said, but Danny Schechter, that's S-C-H, like in school, E-C-H-T-E-R. And check out his work. And, of course, to Janine Bancroft and everyone up here at the station that keeps things going. That's it for me, but do stick around because Arnold's coming straight up with Rhythming to jazz you into this frigid evening here in Victoria. I'll play myself out with more of the Stanfields off their disc, The Vanguard of the Young and Reckless. Until the next time.